everybody. This is Julian Charles of themindrenewed.com, podcasting to you from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And today I'm very pleased to be joined over the internet all the way from Colorado by Dr. Eric Kallstrom, who is Emeritus Professor of Geography at California State University Stanislaus. Throughout his career, Dr. Kallstrom's research has been directly related to paleoclimatology, and he has taught many different courses in physical and environmental geography, including geomorphology, climatology, and human ecology, as well as courses in the geology department. So, Dr. Kallstrom, may I say thank you very much indeed for agreeing to speak to me on The Mind Renewed.
Yes, hello, Julian. Nice to be with you today and to see that our Skype is working so well here.
Now, I said in the introduction that much of your research and teaching has been related to matters of climatology. And I wanted to have you on the podcast because I know that you are somebody who rejects very strongly the hypothesis of anthropogenic global warming. So I wanted to ask you about the reasons why you reject that and what it is that you think is really behind the promotion of this hypothesis. And maybe if we have time towards the end to ask you about your thoughts on geoengineering. But before we get into all that, could you tell us just a little bit more about yourself? And I'm particularly thinking here, in view of the fact that your title is Emeritus Professor of Geography, could you tell us about how your work relates to the study of the Earth's climate in particular?
Yeah, well, of course, geography as a subject breaks down into human geography or cultural geography on the one hand and physical geography on the other hand. Within physical geography, we study landforms or geomorphology, climatology and meteorology, soils, and biogeography. And so we tend nowadays to specialize, and I've always specialized in the study of landforms, soils, and these particular studies are applied to trying to reconstruct landscapes and climates of the past. I did my PhD while I was at University of Calgary on the glacial history of Glacier Waterton Park, which is right along the border between the United States and Canada. And I looked at the soils there in old glacial deposits and was able to make some inferences then about past climates, etc. And then, of course, in the earth science, or sometimes called quaternary geology or physical geography, we all overlap at that point. We're looking for ways to date these deposits to determine how old they are, and then we make our interpretations from there. So we earth scientists use many kinds of proxy data to reconstruct climates and environments of the past. And physical geography and geology both do these kinds of research. And climatology is often taught in geography departments. And I've taught climatology for many years. So it's not such a strange occurrence.
And are there many people who are pure climatologists? Is indeed there such a thing as a pure climatologist?
Well, that's a good question. It's a very small and young field. I've done many interviews with Dr. Tim Ball, who's a Canadian. I think he's kind of touted as the first Canadian PhD in climatology, actually studied under Hubert Lam at the University of London. So it's a young field. I mean, he's now retired as well, but there's just not that many climatologists. And what has happened since governments, basically responding to United Nations dictates, you might say, since governments have put a lot of money into this kind of research, particularly the computer aspects of it, many, many people in many different fields are jumping on the grant bandwagon and claiming to have expertise in climatology. So a lot of the climate scientists that we hear about on the radio are really computer programmers. And what they do is they grab data sets from anywhere they can, and then they crunch it through their computers. And of course, computers are famous for the old adage, garbage in, garbage out. The output will be no better than the accuracy of the assumptions. And my point, and that of many other, what I would call fieldwork-oriented climatologists, is that the assumptions in all these different computer models that are causing these projections of warming into the next century or so, the assumptions are not correct. If you don't have correct assumptions, you cannot, in a deterministic model, which assumes that you know all the factors. We don't know all the factors of climate because it is one of the most complex systems in the world. In fact, the study of chaos theory comes out of the study of meteorology. So meteorologists cannot predict the weather for more than 10 days because of the chaotic condition of the atmosphere and the weather. You have many nonlinear systems interacting. So this is very, very complex science. You know, hopefully we're learning more all the time, but we have a long way to go to be able to forecast beyond 10 days. Certainly we can't forecast in 100 years. And all the models have proven to be wrong because they've all predicted warming, and it's been cooling since about 1998. So, you know, we're now in a realm of virtual reality with the computer models. I'm one of the guys who, you know, went out in the field and got my hands and my feet dirty, brought back samples to the laboratory, and, you know, we're a little more grounded, shall we say, in the physical environment. So in that sense, maybe a little old-fashioned. But it's a different mentality altogether, reality versus virtual reality.
So this will be the main reason then why you reject these wild extrapolations that they talk about, as you say, 50 to 100 years. But could I ask you about some of the main scientific reasons why you reject the hypothesis of anthropogenic global warming itself? So that is, we're told by the mainstream media, this is the consensus of opinion among climate scientists. And it is this idea that we human beings, particularly through the production of carbon dioxide, are contributing substantially to the rise in the average temperature of the Earth's atmosphere and oceans. And it's said that this is likely to have dire consequences for the future. So why is it that you reject, on scientific grounds, that basic hypothesis?
Yeah, well, you know, I would like to refer your listeners to a website that I've put together called naturalclimatechange.us. And on that website is an enormous amount of material. There is an article called Disproofs of the Hypothesis of Man-Caused Global Warming and Proofs that Man-Caused Global Warming is a Fraud. So this is about an 80-page paper that I wrote a couple years ago for my climatology students. Again, my background has been to reconstruct climates of the past. So I'm pretty well versed in climate change patterns over the last, what we call the quaternary period, which is the ice ages, the last 2 or 3 million years. So I'm well aware that it has changed cyclically, that these cycles are quite large, the long-term cycles, and that they seem to respond since about the mid-70s and 80s. There's been another kind of consensus that the main driver for the ice ages, the glacial, interglacial cycles that the world has experienced in the last 2 to 3 million years, the main driver seems to be variations in the Earth's orbit around the sun, which has three periodicities, 100,000 year, 40,000 year, and 20,000 year. And these things interact. So just to give you a snapshot, if we go back 20,000 years, we were in the last glacial maximum, and Canada was covered with 1 to 2 to even 3 miles of ice, which extended down into the northern part of the United States. Most of Britain would have been covered as well. Sea level was about 300, 400 feet lower than it is now. Okay, that's natural climate change. Now go back to 125,000 years ago. That's the last interglacial. We are in an interglacial, by the way, for the last 10,000 years. And we have enjoyed, humans have benefited and enjoyed a very pleasant, stable, and relatively warm climate, which has allowed agriculture to develop and civilization to flourish. Now, 125,000 years ago, of course, humans were not doing agriculture, nor were they driving cars. We were in the previous interglacial, which was warmer than today. And you can look at the fossil evidence and the redistribution of plants and animals around the Earth and soils, which is, again, my topic, to determine that, oh, yeah, it was a different kind of climate even than we've had in the last 10,000 years. Maybe 2 or 3 degrees centigrade warmer, and maybe sea level was 1 or 2 meters higher than it is now. Okay, this isn't all natural. This is not humans driving cars. The way I kind of explain it to my students sometimes, or anybody who wants to know, we're like bugs on a sequoia tree. You know, we don't really understand the age of the sequoia or the big picture because we have a relatively short lifespan. The Earth's been around, they tell us, 3 or 4.5 billion years. And for most of that period, the climate of the Earth has been significantly warmer than today. Estimates go to 8 to 10 degrees centigrade warmer. No tipping points were reached. In fact, during warmer climates, life thrives. And so even to be afraid of a warming is silly from the point of view of somebody who understands something about the long-term patterns of climate change. They talk about the middle of the Holocene, the present 10,000-year period, as being the climatic optimum. Optimum means good. That means it was warmer. and that means creatures thrive, you know. So if we can make it more recent, 1,000 years ago, we're in the medieval warm period. The Vikings expanded because they could sail all over the place because the ice had retreated, or the pack ice was closer to the poles. And of course, the Vikings came down into England and Ireland and all that area of Britain. This was a period, the medieval warm period, between about 900 and 1300 AD, in which growing seasons were longer, lifespans were longer, wealth was greater. This was when the great cathedrals were built. Then the natural climate change was to slide into a cooling, what we now call the Little Ice Age, after 1300 years AD. And then that just ended about 1850, and that's an arbitrary ending. The coldest was in the 1600s. And again, all this is natural. And during this Little Ice Age, especially in the Northern Hemisphere, especially in Europe, of course, we had the plague and we had shorter growing seasons. We had shorter lifespans. Life was harsher and harder for humans and other creatures because of natural climate change. And really, I would argue that, you know, anybody who has a long-term understanding, this would be people who are not computer modelers, people who are earth scientists, would understand that we're still coming out of the Little Ice Age. And this is natural for the most part.
Well, can I ask you, for example, why it is that Professor Julia Slingo, who is the chief scientist at the Met Office, says that the last 50 years cannot be explained by natural changes, but we have to bring in this enhanced level of carbon dioxide, she says, as the cause in order to explain it?
Well, I think she's wrong. I think she's very wrong. You talk about a consensus. I think many of the great voices in my field, now we're talking climatology and earth science, have vehemently protested against this political agenda. I know these people. I've been involved. I've been around long enough to know these people individually. I was the treasurer of the American Quaternary Association, which was is an interdisciplinary group of earth scientists and archaeologists and tree ring people and ocean core people and ice core people, pollen people, biology, geology, anthropology, all the fields that are interested in past environments were loosely allied in this group, the American Quaternary Association, and the international version is the International Quaternary Association. So you get AMQA and INQA. And I know these people because I've been going to the meetings. And these people understand about the patterns of climate change long-term and the short-term cycles, the long-term cycles. And the last 50 years is not out of the norm at all. In fact, we've had very mild warming. In fact, as we'll talk later, even to show the amount of warming, say 1 degree Fahrenheit for the world in the 20th century, many state records have been tampered with. And this came out with various scandals in 2009 called ClimateGate and NASAGate and KiwiGate and AussieGate. In other words, England, the United States, Australia, New Zealand, the national weather reporting centers have actually tampered with the data. This is outrageous and indefensible. There's a quote from a guy that is considered the father of modern American climatology, Reed Bryson, who taught University of Wisconsin for years and really was a great scientist. And he says you can go outside and spit and have just as much effect on global warming as a doubling of carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is not a factor in the climate. What's driving the climate is the sun and variations in solar output as directly affecting the atmosphere and also as indirectly stored in the ocean. The ocean, of course, 71% of the planet is covered with water. The oceans are, you know, maybe 20,000 feet deep on average. There's well over 22 times more heat stored in the oceans than in the atmosphere. And so they moderate the temperature of the Earth. What we have, I think, Julian, is a political agenda to control the economic activity of the world. We have 85% of all energy is related to fossil fuel consumption. Of course, burning of fossil fuel creates carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is a funny thing because it is, yes, it's a product of industrial activity, but it is also absolutely essential for photosynthesis. Without carbon dioxide, there would be no life. So a doubling, a tripling, a quadrupling of carbon dioxide from the present 380 parts per million would only be beneficial for life. It would add more plants. That means more and better conditions for animals and humans. And so the whole thing is preposterous. I mean, warming is good. Carbon dioxide is good. And to get us to be afraid of what's good is, really relies on propaganda and ignorance.
And you say that the idea that the sun is responsible for these changes in the climate, you say that is the most reasonable assumption. But the Met Office, again, says that the sun is ruled out.
Well, actually, there's a guy named Peter Corbin who has been making the most accurate weather predictions based on solar activity. And if you want to check out the movie, The Great Global Warming Swindle, this is came out in Britain in 2007. Martin Durkin made it, and he interviews Corbin. And Corbin is touted as the best weather predictor, and he's looking at a solar variability as a predictor. And there's another scientist that I've interviewed several times. I've interviewed Tim Ball many times. I've interviewed Don Easterbrook, another emeritus professor who's done a lot of work on glacial history, recent glacial history in the American Northwest, and he finds a 30-year cycle. You may be a little younger. You don't perhaps remember that in the mid-70s in this country, there were some very alarmist cover stories on Time magazine to the effect that it had been cooling slightly, the weather, climate, or the temperature has been cooling. So therefore, be afraid of another ice age.
I do remember that, actually.
Okay. Yeah. And then very shortly after, about 1975, temperatures started to go up a little bit. And then the press, almost without missing a beat, went ahead and started making us afraid of global warming, which is quite remarkable. And they exaggerated both. In fact, we have 30-year cycles of cooling and then warming. And so we had warming between about 75 and 98, and it's been cooling since 98. And these are very high frequency, relatively small temperature and climate perturbations.
And yet, again, as Julius Lingo says, the rate of warming in the last 50 years is unprecedented. It's not like what you see in the glacial records, she says.
Well, she's wrong. She's absolutely wrong. I mean, these are what you call lies. And again, there's a lot of grant money out there. Over $100 billion has been spent by governments of the world to prove human influence on climate.
So can I just throw that quote at you then? Exactly what she said. In particular, the rate of warming is far more rapid than we have ever seen in any of those records of glacial and interglacial cycles. So our planet is changing at an unprecedented rate. And that, again, is not consistent with natural cycles within the climate system. And you're saying that that is just untrue.
I'm saying it's outrageously untrue. Look at the data from the Greenland ice sheet ice cores, which has come out. It's on my website. It's on Don Easterbrook's websites. You see radical temperature changes between 20 and 10,000 years ago. Within 100 years, something like, 10 degrees Fahrenheit. And we have not seen anything close to that. We have seen, like I say, even with skewed data sets, we have 1 degree Fahrenheit for the 20th century. And I don't believe that, because I think what has happened is, again, because of the selection of weather stations, et cetera, there's been an attempt to show a warming or an increase in CO2. And I don't think that's there empirically, and then an increase in temperature. I don't think that's there either. Certainly not in places like New Zealand in the Southern Hemisphere and Antarctica, where it's been cooling consistently for the last 40 years. Now, recall 90% of the world's ice is in Antarctica. You need to take these factors into account. The Earth is huge. We have very spotty coverage of the Earth in terms of climate recording stations. Now we have an Argo system of buoys in the ocean, which are these things that go down about 1,000 meters and then report temperatures back up to satellites. So since 2003, we're starting to get some coverage of the oceans of the world. And again, that shows a very slight cooling since 2003. So I'm sorry, this lady is telling something that is extremely irresponsible, because she's scaring people, and it's not true. People need to start looking critically and digging deeper. What happens is the media will focus on her and this particular propaganda ploy and ignore the real scientists, who are the ones that I'm trying to talk about here.
And you say that the sea on average is cooling.
Yes, very slightly.
Since 2003.
Yes.
And yet we are told that the Arctic sea ice is melting.
Well, of course, the Arctic sea ice melts and freezes every year with the season. We have seasons, you know. In the Northern Hemisphere, you know, it's cold in the it's just cold in the winter, and it melts every year in the summer. And the ice does that. The pack ice expands and contracts every year. Likewise, we see the calving of glaciers in coastal areas every year. It's like trees having leaves that fall in the fall.
But the idea is that the rate of melting is greater than it would normally be. That's the idea, isn't it?
Well, it's not true. You know, you asked me earlier what my main points are. Number one, on my open letter to policymakers on my website, naturalclimatechange.us, I say I demonstrate there's no consensus amongst scientists in supporting of this hypothesis. I show that natural climate fluctuations have had a far greater influence than humans on the climate system, and that the claimed rate of warming, 0.06 degrees centigrade in the 20th century, is well within the normal range for natural temperature fluctuations. I show that atmospheric CO2 does not drive temperatures and plays a minor role in the climate system itself. I discuss the historical benefits of relatively warm climates versus more damaging colder climates. I demonstrate that human contributions of CO2 to the atmosphere are minor, about 3.5% as compared with nature's contributions, and also that water vapor is by far the most important greenhouse gas. I detail the many ways in which science fraud has been systematically used and is still being used to create the common misperceptions associated with anthropogenic global warming. I discuss the problems and limitations of the GCMs, global climate models, that provide the basis of the alarmist claims of human-induced global warming. I expose the fallacies of the many propaganda ploys, including melting glaciers, rising sea levels, die-off of polar bears, increase in extreme weather, etc., that are now commonly attributed to anthropogenic global warming. And I speculate on the political, economic, and social agendas served by the anthropogenic global warming fraud.
So the Arctic sea ice is not melting at an unusual rate. The sea levels are not rising unusually, and polar bears are doing okay. Is that right?
Polar bears are actually thriving. If you look at the work of Canadian wildlife biologists, populations are considerably up since 1950s. Polar bears can swim about 100 miles in the water when they need to. So the little funny cartoon in Al Gore's movie about the cartoon ice melting and the polar bear struggling to survive is really silly propaganda. It's really meant for kids. You know, again, the Earth is extremely large. Even in the amongst the Earth scientists, there's always a tendency to be chauvinistic. You know, it's like I go and do my research in Glacier Waterton Park, and then I want that to apply to the whole world. Well, every other Earth scientist does the same thing. Mm. It's like the story of the blind man and the elephant. The story in India where, you know, six blind men touch an elephant, and one touches his leg and says the elephant is like a tree, and one touches his tail and says the elephant is like a rope, and the other touches his side and says the elephant is like a wall. We're all like that. We're all working in a relatively limited area, and we're all human and have limited intelligence, and we extrapolate. But, of course, the Earth is much bigger than most of our minds can comprehend. Models have come in since the 80s. You know, I originally thought it was great, but now I see the limitations of models. I even remember a British TV show. A guy named James Burke was a philosophy of science or a history of science expert, and he was waltzing us through the great scientific innovations. And he got to the 80s and he said, now we're in the age of supercomputers. Reality is what we say it is. Well, I'm sorry, it's not what we say it is. Reality is reality. And you can try to model it and represent it in a computer, but you know, reality is different from virtual reality.
Absolutely, yes, indeed. There's another thing I wanted to ask you about Dr. David Evans' work, where he says that the IPCC models show that there should be a hotspot at the top of the troposphere over the tropical region. But he says that data collected from 1979 to 1999 doesn't show this, and so the signature of warming is not there, and that's really very significant. Significantly disconfirms the theory. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, I think David Evans is an excellent example. He was a global warmer. He was a computer modeler. He believed in the hypothesis. He believed in the political agenda. And then he looked at the data more carefully, looked at the computer models, and he said, okay, computer models predict, if we understand the climate system, that due to human industrial activity, we will see, as you say, a hotspot, increased temperatures near the upper part of the troposphere, oh, maybe, you know, 5 to 10 miles up, something like that. And the data from the satellites and the weather balloons do not show any such hotspot at all. So, you know, being a credible responsible scientist, he said, oops, the hypothesis is disproven. And I think there are many, many, many disproofs of the hypothesis of man-caused global warming. And that's what my paper is all about, those disproofs. Let's treat it like a hypothesis, and then let's see if it stands or falls based on the evidence. And it falls, I'm afraid.
I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the possible fraudulent activities. In mid-November 2009, the servers of the Climatic Research Unit at UEA, University of East Anglia, were hacked. We're not sure whether that was external or whether it was a whistleblower inside the department. We're not sure about that.
Right.
And a great deal of data was released, and lots of emails, and so we had our Climategate affair.
Right.
Now, do you think that those emails definitely point in the direction of fraud, or do you think it's just mismanagement?
Well, I think it's a continuum. I think both are involved. I think you have a small group starting at the Climate Research Unit, but with their colleagues in the United States and to some extent Australia and New Zealand, and they formed a team. And I think that there is has been a very concerted attempt on the part of this relatively small team to take the position of editorships at the pertinent journals like Nature, et cetera, and to feature the work of their team, like Michael Mann was one who came out with the famous hockey stick graph, just like a hockey stick turned up where the blade is turned up. That would represent the last a time series of temperatures over the last 1,000 years, and then relatively stable temperature for 1,000 years, and then all of a sudden it gets warm in the latter part of the 20th century. Well, to get a graph like that, I mean, he had to do some real serious statistical fraud and manipulation. He had to handpick a few tree ring sets from California and ignore all the others. He had to get rid of the medieval warm period and the Little Ice Age, which are in almost all the climatic records. And then he had to exaggerate the amount of warming. So what we see then, I think, is science fraud. There are a couple Canadian statisticians that question this, McKittrick and McIntyre. Mm-hmm. And this caused a congressional investigation of Mann's work. I think it was fuzzy enough, the outcome, that both sides could claim victory. But my view is that they showed it to be fraudulent. My own knowledge of the past 1,000 years and the science that goes into our reconstructions tells me it's fraudulent. Let me give you a statement by a guy named Ian Wishar in a book called AirCon, The Seriously Inconvenient Truth About Global Warming. He said, manipulation of raw data is at the heart of recent claims of corrupt scientific practice in climate science. With CRU's, that's Climate Research Unit, Phil Jones recently claiming old temperature records by his organization were, quote, destroyed or, quote, lost, meaning researchers can now only access manipulated data. So, this came out in the scandal known as Climategate in 2009. It's funny, I was teaching climatology at the time, and this came out during our class, and I'd been telling students that this was fraudulent, and this happened, and they started to believe me after Climategate. Here's another quote. This is by Dr. David Deming in his testimony before the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee in 2006. He said, in 1995, I published a short paper in the academic journal Science. In that study, I reviewed how borehole temperature data recorded a warming of about 1 degree Celsius in North America over the last 100 to 150 years. The week the article appeared, I was contacted by a reporter for National Public Radio. He offered to interview me, but only if I would state that the warming was due to human activity. When I refused to do so, he hung up on me. I had another interesting experience around the time my paper in Science was published. I received an astonishing email from a major researcher in the area of climate change. He said, "We have got to get rid of the medieval warm period."
Yes, I've heard that quote before. And that's what makes the hockey stick seem even more impressive, isn't it? The medieval warm period is downplayed so much.
Yes, yeah. In fact, I think the medieval warm period was probably considerably greater warming than what we've seen in what we call the modern warming post-1950. But again, we're cooling now. So, you know, time and science, I have faith that time and science will sort this out. We will see that there has been an attempt on the part of governments and elites to manipulate a small science. Then we can start to look and see if there are other incidences in, you know, recent human history when sciences have been corrupted to political ends. And we can see, yes, this happened with the eugenics movement in the early 20th century in the United States, a lot of it in Yale. we can see that psychology and behavioral sciences have been strongly manipulated by intelligence and military operations in the subject of mind control. We can see that in Russia, this crazy guy Lysenko kind of subverted the whole basis of biological research. People starved as a result of that. We can see that governments break in and corrupt sciences to advance their political purposes.
Yeah. It's interesting how people are more ready to believe that it could happen in the former Soviet Union, but not that it could happen in the West. Not to us. We wouldn't do that.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
And you have concerns also about the accuracy of surface station data from around the world.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Again, the four cases in point where I think we see manipulation of data is not only the CRU out of University of East Anglia with Phil Jones, but it's also with NASA, which takes a lot of its data, by the way, from CRU. And it's also in Australia and New Zealand. Here's a statement out of Climate Audit website, which is Stephen McIntyre, the Canadian statistician. He said, NASA has yet to own up fully to its historical error in misinterpreting U.S. surface temperatures to conform with the global warming hypothesis. A statement by a guy named Booker in 2010, he says, when Phil Jones, the now disgraced and suspended director of the Climate Research Unit of the University of East Anglia, claimed that he had lost most of the raw data that he and others have used to pronounce the impending doom of our little planet from anthropogenic global warming, the official word from the warmists was that it made no difference because the completely separate databases of NASA and NOAA, this is an American, these are American agencies, showed the same results. The fact that CRU's raw data had been randomly and arbitrarily twisted to fit their goals of getting massive grants to continue their, quote, research, supposedly didn't alter the fact that the science was settled. In light of those pronouncements, it turns out that NASA has only been using their own data for U.S. climate modeling. They have been using the CRU data for world climate modeling because they consider their own data to be inferior. It further turns out that NASA has routinely been adjusting its modeling based on the models of the CRU and NOAA. There's nothing remotely independent about NASA's climate models. The AGW scam unravels more every day. Well, let me just mention something. Reliable temperature records around the world are very spotty. I mean, the first good recording temperature stations, you know, go back maybe in some areas to 1850. The coverage is very spotty for the whole planet. But it was 1979 that we started to get satellites. We got weather balloons coming in around the 40s and 50s. And now since 2003, we have the Argo buoys in the ocean. But meanwhile, what we see sometimes in warming trends, like in the 80s, can be entirely explained by the fact that many, many temperature recording stations, say in the Soviet Union, are no longer included in the records. Or we find in some of the official records that they, oops, put the September records in October, thus making it seem like, you know, October is uncommonly warm. And again, in New Zealand, we see temperature records in the early part of the 20th century are actually lowered, and temperature records in the later part of the 20th century actually increased. And that's just to get our tiny little 1 degree Fahrenheit warming. Fortunately, we have some statisticians like the McIntyre and McKittrick who've been looking at these things. Show me the data. Where does the data come from? You know, go back to the very basics and put a lot of eyes on it. And this now, I think, has been done sufficiently to show that this hypothesis is disproven.
Well, I want to ask you a bit more about the political angle on all this. The IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, well, it kind of presents itself as a fundamentally scientific institution. So when it presents its reports, the claim is that this is always the best state of the science. But many people say that it's really a political organization. It's not so much interested in the science. It really wants a desirable political outcome. And so it's perhaps even manipulating the science towards this. Do you agree with that assessment?
Oh, absolutely. And I think this is a point that's very well made in many, many books now. Basically, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is a United Nations group, and the signatories in the club there are all governments. So the governments then are the ones that are putting forth these policy statements, and they are what I would say they were finding scientists to back up their political positions. And you see this in the actual process by which these reports are written every several years. They actually write the policy summary first. and they have political people doing that. And then if the scientists aren't on board, they put all kinds of pressure on them. And a number of the top scientists, like Paul Ritter out of France, have resigned in protest. And when their names were not taken from the list of top 200 scientists, they sued to be taken off the list. So it's a political manipulation. If you look at the terms of reference of the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, they're written by a guy named Maurice Strong, very high in the UN, and they define climate change as climate change caused by human activity. So in that definition, then, they completely overlook and ignore the much, much stronger influence of nature, which, of course, is what I've always studied. So right there, they've skewed the data and they've skewed the results just by the terms of reference.
Could you say anything more about Maurice Strong? Because you said he's this Canadian businessman. He's a bit of a green guru, isn't he? And doesn't he have a large area in the U.S. called the Baca Grande?
Well, your question is very provocative. I happen to live in Crestone, Colorado, in the Baca Grande subdivision, on the edge of the Baca National Wildlife Refuge, which is what's now the use for an old Spanish land grant called the Juan Luis Maria Baca Spanish Land Grant. Maurice Strong owned that for a while in the 70s, or he was a director of the Arizona Land and Cattle Corporation here back in the 70s. And he was, again, a rich Canadian industrialist who was head of Petro-Canada, the largest oil company there, and head of Ontario Hydro, the largest of the water agencies there, which I'm told he almost wrecked. Anyway, so he's a billionaire and he's an industrialist and he's an oil and gas and water CEO and many, many, many other businesses. He also was Captain Planet, one of the leaders of the environmental movement in the United Nations. He was the Secretary General of the Rio Earth Summit in 1992, which gave us Agenda 21, or the Agenda for the 21st Century. He was the organizer of the Stockholm Global Environmental Conference in 1972, and he was a principal in the recent follow-up conference in 2012. So every 20 years, they have these conferences. But yeah, he wears this environmentalist hat on the one hand, and then he wears this developer hat. And once I started looking into his background, I realized how incredibly hypocritical this whole thing is. The environmental movement has been steered by the very powers that be that are the gas and oil and water monopolists. And he is a, you know, associate of the Rockefeller family and the Rothschild family. And we're dealing with now the world's power elite. And the environmental movement, I've come to realize, finally, is really a kind of a new version of, well, they say green is the new red. They talk about watermelon environmentalists, you know, green on the outside, red on the inside. And this gives me some pain because I've always considered myself to be an environmentalist. But I've just finally woken up to the fact that this movement has been hijacked. But yeah, Maurice Strong is quite an interesting character. And he himself, this character, was the one who helped me by looking at his track record and his background and his activities. This helped me to understand what's really going on with the environmental movement and the United Nations, for that matter. The United Nations is attempting to control world's food and water for the benefit of the corporatocracy. We can call it the green corporatocracy. So now I'm advising my students and anybody who will listen, you know, hold on to the U.S. Constitution, hold on to local representative democracy, because these guys are not in favor of that. They're in favor of a one world government with them in control.
It was a very interesting quote that I read from Maurice Strong when he was interviewed for West magazine back in 1990, where he was talking about a novel that he wanted to write. And he said that in the novel, there was a rich group of people meeting at Davos who were trying to decide whether they were going to give up their nation's wealth in order to save the planet. And he says in the book, he says he's going to write that they decide, no, they're not going to do this. The only hope for the planet is that the industrialized civilizations collapse, says Maurice Strong. And isn't it our responsibility to bring that about?
Yeah, that quote is featured on, actually, I've got a couple PowerPoints and articles about Maurice Strong on my website there, too. And I also have that quote. Yeah, it's the old Hegelian dialectic of problem, reaction, solution, whereby the ruling elite has learned to manage the rest of us through managed conflict, you know, thesis, antithesis, synthesis. you know, through managing conflict, they can kind of move the body politic in the direction desired. So they scare us with the idea that we're wrecking the world, that we're wrecking the planet, and that in order to save the planet, we've got to make these huge lifestyle sacrifices. We have to go back to a pre-industrial economy, for instance, which is really what would happen if we all followed Kyoto Protocol Phase 2 and cut out 85 or 90 or 100% of our fossil fuel use. We would go back to a pre-industrial lifestyle, and we couldn't feed everybody, so we'd have to crash the world population by, say, 3/4 or so. Well, you know, the ruling elite's always been Malthusian. They've always said there's too many people and not enough resources. But my feeling is they don't want to share. My feeling is they want it all. And this, I think history proves this. So again, it's a huge con. They're conning people with the media to believe that it's our fault and that there is some sort of planetary emergency. Well, there's no planetary emergency except perhaps what the militaries are doing with all this geoengineering. And that is mostly, you know, very secret, but it is something that could be stopped tomorrow. So in other words, the Earth's been around for 4.5 billion years and it's doing quite well. The sun's been around for about 5 billion years. It's got another 5 billion years to go. The Earth's got at least another billion years of relatively stable conditions in terms of climate before it starts to overheat from the sun. There is no emergency. What there is a ruling elite which wants to deindustrialize the industrial world and depopulate the world. And I think they're the ones that should volunteer to leave the planet if they think that there's too many people.
They did actually say, didn't they? The Club of Rome said in 1991 that they thought that the threat of pollution, threat of global warming would be a good way to bring the world together under a sort of proto-world government.
That's right. The Club of Rome book called The First Global Revolution. And I think there is a statement in there to the effect that, you know, we looked around for another cause that can unite us other than war and thought that environmental degradation and global warming might fill the bill. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How do you react to the way the slogan has changed from global warming to climate change? And then last year, the BBC did a Horizon program, which they called Global Weirding.
Well, okay, Julian, I've got good question. I've got a PowerPoint that I did, and it's on my naturalclimatechange.us website. I was invited to be part of a panel discussion at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco about a year and a half ago on the topic of man-made climate change in the skies. There were four of us. And this is a pretty big deal. It's the oldest public forum center in America. So you have, you know, guys like Gorbachev and Clinton and whatnot speaking there, including Michael Crichton. And if people really want to understand this whole issue, I recommend them this interesting book of fiction called A State of Fear by Michael Crichton, who is a Harvard-trained doctor. And he wrote a great book in which he came up with the conclusion that the man-caused global warming issue is a fraud. It's being pushed by environmentalists to achieve political agendas. And the reality is geoengineering. In fact, in my PowerPoint, I talk about the history of geoengineering. It goes back to World War II. And the various governments of the world, such as the U.S. and Britain and Soviet Union and whatnot, have all been involved to a large extent in trying to modify the weather for military purposes. And you can find lots of statements that go back into the 50s and 60s about what they thought they were going to be able to do. Well, they can do that now. They can steer a hurricane. They can steer the jet stream. They can create floods and droughts because they know where the vapor rivers are, which circle the globe, and they can block them with adding energy from, say, the HAARP facilities, the High Active Frequency Auroral Research Program in Alaska. But there's about 10 or 20 other of these ionospheric heaters around the world, a couple in the Soviet Union, and one or two in Norway, one in Puerto Rico. They're all over the place. They can bounce extremely low-frequency radio waves up to the ionosphere. We're talking billions of watts of energy, and they can bounce it down anywhere they want on the Earth and therefore steer weather systems. In fact, going back to the 50s and 60s, you see lots of patents. You see lots of statements by scientists of what they're going to be able to do. Well, they can do that now. They can steer hurricanes. They can create earthquakes by adding these energies in critical places where there's a threshold which once crossed creates, again, an earthquake or something like that.
So is it your belief that they are doing this?
Yes, it is. I went to Joplin, Missouri last year as I crossed the country. And in Joplin, Missouri, there was a outbreak of super tornadoes about a year and a half ago. And the biggest one was actually a merging of two, and it went 14 miles on the ground right through town, north-south, took out four blocks, about a mile wide and 14 miles long. In all the historical documents, tornadoes skip around. They don't go straight, and they don't stay on the ground. They're bouncing up and down all the time and doing weird things because they're in a very turbulent system. Well, this particular tornado could have been directed. Now, this is also brought up in Michael Crichton's book, State of Fear. Increasing the potency of lightning strikes, aiming and increasing the potency of hurricanes and tornadoes, all of these would be under the influence, under the rubric of environmental warfare. There is a document written for the Air Force in 1996 called Weather as a Force Multiplier, Owning the Weather in 2025. And it is my contention that a lot of the research money that has been spent to study climate change, global warming, et cetera, has gone into military computer type research, which in fact involve tracking the weather patterns and altering them as needed. And again, this is a fantastic kind of warfare because it is covert. You can always say, oh, well, nature did that. And of course, it can be applied anywhere in the world by whoever has the methodology and the technology.
So you're saying in a way that they're giving up, the powers that be are giving up on the idea of global warming because it just doesn't seem to be happening over the last 15 years or so, and that they're therefore turning to this other generation of phenomena and then saying, well, this is still caused by human production of CO2, but it's global weirding, it's strange weather formations.
Yes. Yeah. So we've gone from global warming to climate change to climate disruption is what we hear over here. And throughout the time period of this huge political push, we have watched the media scramble to stay ahead of perceptions and to mold perceptions. And these terms are being used in order to control the debate and seem credible. But I don't think that they are credible. I think that real science has disproved them.
So you're saying that not only is this possible to do, it is in fact being done. So how would we find any evidence that this is in fact taking place?
Well, I think if you look at the trajectory of Hurricane Sandy that just smashed into New York City, and then the trajectory of Hurricane Katrina 2005, you see some, you know, pretty strange behavior. You know, there are kind of telltale signs and fingerprints, but I haven't really jumped into the field of trying to prove, you know, what is natural and what is not in that arena. I think that's a very important thing to do. I've just kind of kept an eye on what's happening. It's a good question. In terms of earthquakes, it's possible that there's a lot more of these piezoelectric effects. The rainbow lights that you find sometimes associated with an earthquake may well be much more intense where you have directed energy causing the earthquake. So, yeah, I think that it's possible, and I think probably some people are doing it. This is what needs to be done to monitor these particular events to determine the natural from the man-caused. Now, here's where I think the rubber meets the road. I don't think human activities such as burning fossil fuels have any effect on the Earth's climate. However, I think that the military and these governments have the potential to affect weather locally and may in the long term have the ability to affect climate. Now, climate, of course, is just average weather. And but mostly it seems to be local effects, regional effects that they are able to accomplish.
But the way our conversation has gone so far, it would seem to be that you're saying that they are certainly able to do this, but we can't actually pin it down and say they are definitely doing this. So this remains a hypothesis which we should take seriously, but we can't say this is actually going on.
Well, that would be the conservative, most responsible position. I would say that the militaries or even perhaps the United Nations are doing two things in the skies. They're spraying, and one can look up at the sky and see the spraying from the jets, which includes many charged particles and metals that actually change the composition of the atmosphere. And this is on a global scale for the last 20 years. And they're zapping with the HAARP and things like that. And it could be that the spraying and the zapping are operating together so that whoever is trying to influence and control weather patterns is able to do so, such as, again, steering the jet stream and the vapor rivers, creating floods in some areas, creating drought in other areas. I would say this is happening. I don't think there's any question this is happening. I think it's been happening for over 20 years. Now, whether a particular event such as Superstorm Sandy or Hurricane Katrina or the Joplin tornadoes is a result of these kinds of technologies, this, again, is speculation. My speculation is that they are.
Okay.
But I haven't proved it. So, again, I think it needs to be looked at.
Okay. Well, what about the general idea of this geoengineering in the skies? You say that that is certainly happening. And I looked at Michael Murphy's documentary, What in the World Are They Spraying? I thought it was a good documentary. And I thought the case was made certainly very well that there is some kind of spraying going on, certainly locally. But I thought that the evidence that was brought to suggest that this is global was a bit anecdotal. Would you say that this is going on globally?
Yes, I think that, you know, if you do a little digging, you see the term Operation Cloverleaf, which would have started in the early 90s. I actually have pictures of this kind of spraying back in the 80s, so I know it started before the early 90s, but I think the global program might have started around 1992, something like that. Again, yes, it is anecdotal, but if you start looking at the photos even from space, you see the amount of spraying which is occurring, which is new. It's a new phenomenon in the history of the world. And you have to ask yourself who's doing it and why. I saw the movie as well, and there's many other good movies about this. And then you get to people like Edward Teller at the Lawrence Livermore Lab, who's sometimes referred to as Dr. Strangelove. Huh. He wrote a paper in 1994 about how we could control the climate in the future by the kind of spraying that we're doing now. And then there's one of his colleagues, a guy by the name of Lowell, who's sometimes called, I think he's called Dr. Evil. Anyway, he also says, you know, we've engineered everything else. Why not the planet? Mm. So this mentality is coming from our top research institutions like the Lawrence Livermore Lab, you know, and Alamos, where they created the atomic bomb. So we got some very smart people doing these things, and we have governments funding them.
Yes, yes. And I think the case is made very clear that this is being suggested. This was in the documentary, but I've seen and read other things that suggest that this is being discussed at the highest levels. But you admit it is somewhat anecdotal to say, well, that it's happening on a global scale. And when I look up into the skies, I find it very difficult to differentiate between a normal contrail and one that is a chemtrail. How do I tell the difference between the two?
Well, a normal contrail, mostly water vapor, and it should dissipate within 5 seconds at the most. Contrail will last 24 hours and spread out over thousands of square miles. When I got up this morning and looked out of my window here in Colorado, I saw three trails immediately that were either, you can call them chemtrails or persisting contrails is what the Air Force calls them. And let me go back to the laws. In 2010, there were four or five bills that went through the House of Commons and the U.S. House of Representatives, pretty much same laws, saying somebody's got to regulate and control and monitor geoengineering, and we're going to start to do it. Okay, this is in 2010. And so the laws were being written and being considered while Michael Murphy made his movie. And perhaps you remember when he went up to all those different congressmen and asked them about the spraying, and they all looked like they didn't know what he was talking about. So on the one hand, they're playing ignorant. On the other hand, they're actually trying to finally admit to it. Well, it's my position. They've been doing this since the 40s. In fact, in my PowerPoint, Man-Made Climate Change in the Skies, I give the history of these things. You know, Operation Popeye was cloud seeding in the Vietnam War to flood the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Operation Cumulus back in the 70s was to see if they could increase or decrease hurricane strength and guide them. You know, I mean, there are so many of these things that are so well documented that one sees a trajectory of innovations and inventions and patents and laws that all pertain to this. But this is what the media has not been talking about. The media is trying to blame us for something that we, the consumer, the energy consumer, the car driver, are not responsible for at all.
Mm-hmm. So to return to that then, do you agree, or presumably you would not agree, that the so-called precautionary principle is a good idea?
Well, that's a good question, Julian. You know, for over 20 years, I taught a course called Human Ecology, which is, you know, talking about all the different environmental issues. And for the first 10 years, I was more or less teaching out of the book, which is mostly biology based. And the book basically is saying that, oh, there's too many people. The climate is warming because, and it's our fault, and we're getting a tremendous loss of biodiversity. And we're, you know, this is terrible and this is terrible. And, you know, the sky's falling. And it was really a very depressing course to teach and probably to take. But after 2000, I started to read some of the conservative literature and Christians, et cetera. And they had an entirely different worldview on this stuff. I used to think the precautionary principle was a good idea. But essentially what the precautionary principle does is it robs the present generation, or it kind of claims to rob the present generation to protect the future generations. And this plays out in some very strange ways. Like, one of the best books on the whole climate change thing is a book by a paleoclimatologist out of Australia. And he quotes some of the local newspapers in Australia telling, you know, the students they should calculate the age at which they die so that they can make room for other people. And of course, this gets into the whole carbon footprint and then water footprint and then nitrogen footprint, so that now some global government can give you an allowance of each of these essential materials and tell you if you're productive enough to actually deserve to go any more than your allowance or less, et cetera. The book I'm talking about is called Climate, the Counter Consensus by Professor Robert M. Carter of Australia. He's a great speaker, and he's come up to the United States and given many good talks on this that you could Google. There's a chapter he's got here in chapter 10 called The Cost of Precaution. Here's this coming from the UK House of Commons Select Committee on Science and Technology, 2006. We can confirm our initial view that the term precautionary principle should not be used and recommend that it cease to be included in policy guidance. In our view, the terms precautionary principle and precautionary approach, in isolation from any such clarification, have been the subject of such confusion and different interpretations as to be devalued and of little practical help, particularly in public debate. So I now see that the precautionary principle is kind of a club that can be used to frighten people and to make them change their behavior. In other words, it can be misused.
Mm-hmm. And that in practice, probably it would be better to just deal with whatever comes along, whatever problems, and spend the money at that time in the future.
As we always have. Adapt to changes as they occur. You know, this is the genius of our species. And, you know, I do have faith in our intelligence and our ability to solve problems and to respond to changes in climate. Our forebears lived through the last interglacial and the last glacial. And that involved a shifting of sea level by about 300 and 400 feet. So obviously they're pretty clever.
And do you feel that most people in the general public don't go along with this anymore and don't actually believe the propaganda that's coming through from the media?
I think studies show that well over half of the American people are not taken in by this. They don't think that the sky's falling, that the climate is warming precipitously, or that changes in our behavior are warranted. And of course, what this does then is it gives the people in Washington and the governments the excuse then to say, well, and as some have, the czar of science, a guy named, I think it's Holder or Holdren.
John Holdren, yes.
Yeah, John Holdren. Mm. You know, he's made statements, you know, nothing's off the table. We might have to look at geoengineering. In other words, since people aren't ready to give up their fossil fuels, we're going to have to cool the climate by solar radiation management, which I talked about earlier, which again gets back to the spraying and the creation of artificial high clouds that block incoming solar radiation. Well, this is a very outlandish and outrageous fix for a non-problem.
It seems a very, very dangerous move indeed to mess about to such extent. You don't really know what you're doing, do you, on that kind of level?
Absolutely. That's very true. There's kind of a damn the torpedoes Edward Teller approach here. Now, Edward Teller, the guy who invented the nuclear bomb, again, wrote that paper in 94 talking about a global spraying project as being the most cost-effective way to, you know, stabilize global temperatures. He's the guy who recommended that we use nuclear bombs to create extra harbors along the coast of Alaska and Maine.
Good heavens.
He's a madman, and that's why they call him, you know, Dr. Strangelove. He's a genius and a madman. So, yeah, I think we need to write those suggestions off completely.
And I have to say, I do find it rather difficult to accept John Holdren in the position that he is, considering his background. He co-authored a book, Ecoscience, and it was looking at the population problem and suggesting various population control methods, which were pretty unpleasant, I think.
Yeah, he was a partner with Paul Ehrlich and Ann Ehrlich. And of course, Ehrlich had written the book Overpopulation. And these people were very strong environmental ideologues, so strong that both Ehrlich and Holdren recommend in their book that, you know, the government might have to step in to reduce the population, reduce fertility rates or whatever. And again, that's a whole nother debate. You know, what's the carrying capacity of the Earth for human beings? The responsible estimates would range from a low of about 1 billion humans to about 30 billion. And of course, we have 7 billion now. And if you go with the high estimates, we're well within the range the Earth can support. And if you go with the low estimates, like the UN commissions tend to do, then we've got to get rid of some of those pesky human beings. And of course, I think a lot of this is just an attempt to do that. And I know you're broadcasting in a Christian station. The basic principle of Christianity to me is that, you know, humans are precious in the sight of God and not to be squandered and thrown away and killed off for some stupid, bogus, convoluted non-problem.
Absolutely. Made in the image of God, I would say.
Yes, exactly. So it does come down to that, really. What's your attitude towards human beings? The environmentalist attitude I've come to learn is fairly misanthropic, that humans are a form of pollution. In the extreme form, you know, save the planet, kill all the people. And then the Christian view, which I'm much more allied with, is that, yes, each human is precious, is made in the image of God, and we can work this out, you know.
And the Club of Rome has actually called us the cancer.
Yes, that does seem, unfortunately, to be the attitude of the ruling elite towards the masses. There is always class warfare. And this, I think, is a component of the class warfare. So I think perhaps an accurate view of the global warming fraud would be class warfare.
Well, could you recommend any good resources if people want to find out more about this? You have your own website, of course, but are there any other books and websites that you would recommend to look into this?
Oh, absolutely. I'll just throw out some of the titles that are on my shelf here. Tim Ball was involved in a recent book. He's the Canadian climatologist who was a student of Hubert Lam. He's got a book recently, Slaying the Sky Dragon, Death of the Greenhouse Gas Theory. Award-winning earth scientist from Australia named Ian Plimer has written a very encyclopedic book that I used in my climatology class called Heaven and Earth, Global Warming, The Missing Science. And he says basically everything about the global warming hypothesis is wrong. Now, a more policy-oriented book is written by a non-climatologist, Steve Gorham. It's called Climatism! Science, Common Sense, and the 21st Century's Hottest Topic. Another excellent book is written by S. Fred Singer, who's very high in the U.S. Government, and Dennis T. Avery, called Unstoppable Global Warming Every 1,500 Years. Great title. In other words, this is cyclical, ladies and gentlemen. There's a book by Patrick J. Michaels, another longtime emeritus professor, ecologist, The True State of Global Warming. It's called Shattered Consensus. There's a great new theory coming from a couple top climate scientists from Denmark, actually, and an English science writer named Nigel Calder, called The Chilling Stars, A New Theory of Climate Change. This is another top climatologist who was with NASA, Roy Spencer. Climate Confusion, How Global Warming Hysteria Leads to Bad Science, Pandering Politicians, and Misguided Policies That Hurt the Poor. And then I mentioned the book by Ian Weishart, AirCon, The Seriously Inconvenient Truth About Global Warming. There's a couple books about the hockey stick. One's called The Hockey Stick Illusion, Climate Gate and the Corruption of Science by A.W. Montford. This is quite an encyclopedic book.
I've actually read that one. That is a very good book.
Yeah. Some of these books are really well written, and I think they're coming to the rescue here. Nigel Lawson is another one of your countrymen and also a politician. An Appeal to Reason, A Cool Look at Global Warming. And then there's a book by Christopher Booker, The Real Global Warming Disaster. He says the real global warming disaster is the obsession with climate change turning out to be the most costly scientific blunder in history. So that gives you something to go on.
People can start there.
People can start there, yeah. These guys are scientists to the rescue, really.
Well, Dr. Karlstrom, I'm very, very grateful to you for coming on the podcast. You've certainly given us, and certainly me anyway, a huge amount to think about. It was much broader than I thought it was going to be, actually. So thank you very much indeed for sparing all this time to talk to us on The Mind Renewed.
Well, it's a pleasure talking to you, Julian. You're a good interviewer and obviously well-versed with the subject, so I'm very happy to have the time to talk, and I'm sure glad the Skype worked so well.